Todrick Pad Guffey and Kimberly Hansen may have come from different worlds, but there was no denying their love connection. While their marriage starts off with love and passion, over time it descends into bitterness, jealousy, and finally, pure, seething hatred. Until finally, it spills over into murder. Hello and welcome to The Dark Side of Love. I am your host, Bianca Sloan, author of suspense novels about the dark side of love. And this week I'm putting a spotlight on the case I'm calling The Wrong Side of Love. It's 1986, and it's just a regular night in Las Cruces, New Mexico, where 18-year-old Pad Guffey is hanging out with his buddies at a local burger joint. Pad, with his dark hair and wide smile, was described by his friend Stacy Jones to Fatal Vows as, quote, kind of a smooth talker. And it's while he's hanging out at the local burger joint that he lays eyes on pretty blonde waitress 18-year-old Kimberly Hansen, hoping, it seems, to put some of that smooth talk on her. But Kimberly, who hails from South Valley, which I guess would be considered the other side of the tracks of Las Cruces, she was a cheerleader at Mayfield High School, and she was described by Pad's friend Walter Kuykendall in Fatal Vows as very popular and always smiling. Jamie Foreman, Pad's friend, indicated to Fatal Vows that Pad was gobsmacked by the Kim, saying that he was, quote, mesmerized. It was kind of mystical. Kim, being from the wrong side of the tracks while Pad lived in affluent North Valley, was considered kind of exotic. In fact, it only added to her allure. While Pad doesn't get her number that night, he gets another opportunity a few weeks later when their paths cross as a party, and the attraction at this point, it's just too hard to ignore. So much so, Kim is not paying any attention to the guy she came to the party with, sneaking off with Pad instead. And from that night on, the wealthy North Valley guy and the working class South Valley girl are madly in love. So Pad, he comes from old money, a very traditional, very conservative family. And his family owned a drilling company, so we're actually talking here about generational wealth. This is not the same stock that Kim comes from. Her dad worked for the electric company, so it's a much more blue-collar background. Pad's friend Jamie Foreman commented in Fatal Vows that he believed Pad's father, Michael, he wasn't all that fond of Kim, basically believing that she must have been some kind of an opportunist, you know, gold digger. While Kim's mom hopes that the wealthy Guffey family will treat her daughter with respect. Despite these seeming obstacles, the relationship lasts through the end of high school and all throughout Pad's time as a student at New Mexico State University, where he earns a bachelor's degree in marketing. Kim, for her part, she skips college and goes right into the job market, going to work for a computer sales company and making a hell of a lot more money than she did slinging burgers and fries at the local drive-thru. Pad is incredibly impressed with Kim's hard work and her drive, and he determines, you know what, this is the one. Kim is the girl that I'm going to marry. So, after 5 years of dating, he proposes and Kim happily accepts. Despite the continued reservations that Pad's father has and that Kim's mom has, the couple marry in 1991 and begin their focus on trying to have a baby. It's not going well, so instead, they shift their careers into high gear. Kim continues to excel in her corporate career while Pad joins the lucrative family drilling business. So while the baby making might not be going their way, Pad and Kim are making money hand over fist, and their finances and their careers are heading in the right direction. However, things come crashing down when Pad's father is killed in a workplace accident. A devastated Pad, who is the only child, he feels like he's got to step in to take over the business, and that's exactly what he does. And in the process, he brings along the hardworking and ambitious Kim on board with him. So on paper, this seems like a good idea, working together. But the drilling industry, it really isn't Kim's passion. As Pad's friend Stacy Jones told Fatal Vows, quote, at first, I think she submerged herself into it and went full-fledged. But I think eventually it started to wear on her. She wanted something way more glamorous and probably way more fashionable than to be a well driller. And speaking of glamour, Pat happens to notice one day that Kim has traded in the engagement ring that he gave her for something more in the lifestyle that she was quickly becoming accustomed to. Pat's friend Jamie told Fatal Vows, quote, "I know it hurt him. I know it bothered him. Like what I gave her wasn't enough." The couple moves past this and they turn their attention to building the business and eventually back to building their family. Their son Cooper was born in 2000, and somehow, instead of bringing them closer, the birth of their son seems to push them further apart. According to what Pad's friend Jamie told Fatal Vows, Pad, though he loved his son very much, quote, "wasn't a super hands-on dad." Kim seems to resent this laissez-faire approach, and she starts pretty much doing everything because she feels apparently that she has to. As Jamie told Fatal Vows, quote, "she obviously wore the pants in the relationship." In fact, Pat is just kind of hands-off in general, it seems. For example, when it comes time for the family to move on up to this lavish gated community of Mesilla, instead of supervising the move, you know, being on site for all of the attendant last-minute things that come when you move, Pat's on the golf course, which, rightfully so, infuriates Kim. So this relationship, which started off with so much love and passion, it's unraveling. And as Pad's friend Walter told Fatal Vows, Pad's, quote, "expectation was to be happy, and I don't think he was." All of that passion between Kim and Pad has swirled down the drain, and they were basically roommates at this juncture, because on top of everything else, the marriage has become totally sexless. Well, it's hard to stay in a marriage, a relationship of any kind, if you're not happy. So when I look into my crystal ball regarding Kim and Pad, I see trouble with a capital T. Adding to those troubles was Pad's penchant for the club, specifically strip clubs. The rationale, apparently, was that a lot of business that he was courting for his drilling company, his clientele wanted to be taken to the local strip club. So he was just doing his part, taking one for the team, you know, doing what he had to do. Kim, meanwhile, who had never been terribly interested in the drilling business, decides it's time to do something different. And she starts a design business. And to start off, apparently, because what else would you do? She starts getting cozy with one of her clients. And Pat even walks in on them one day about to kiss, something Kim wasn't embarrassed or apologetic about. Now, no one knows if Kim and this client are actually having an affair, but whatever Pat did see, it's enough to send him into a spiral. So his friend Jamie tells Fatal Vows that Pat was pretty devastated, actually, at the prospect of Kim cheating on him with this guy, saying, quote, "there was more than one occasion that he wanted to know what he should do, to the point of tears, like cried. I mean, we cried it out on the phone." Things become super uncomfortable when the same guy, this client of Kim's that she's getting all cozied up with, he comes to the bar where Pad is throwing her a birthday party. Now, Pad did not invite this guy, but, you know, what's an invitation? Who needs an evite? Well, it turns out that Kim actually extended the invitation, which, not cool. But at any rate, the guy even has the stones to buy Kim a drink, which is about 10 bridges too far, quite frankly. And as Pad's friend Walter astutely notes in Fatal Vows, quote, "that's Pad's wife. You're not on a date." Hashtag facts. So Kim is flirting with the guy, lapping up the attention while Pad is seething. And he finally goes up to the guy and says, "you know what? Get the F out before I kick you out." If you can believe this, Pad is the one who gets thrown out of the party that he's paying for. Make that make sense. I can't make it make sense. Can you? If you can, let me know. Tell me. Kim is pretty ticked at her husband for causing a scene, and she confronts him when she gets home. And in response, Pad tells her, you know what, stop flirting with this guy. Enough is enough. She agrees, so long as he stops hanging out at the strip clubs. He agrees, So the couple, they seem to come to an understanding, and for a hot minute anyway, it seems as though there will be peace in the valley. Well, it doesn't last. That's why we're here, because of course it's not going to last. In fact, Pad takes things just a touch too far by having a one-night stand, which Kim does not find amusing. And things really come to a head when Kim finds out that Pad has planned an impromptu 4th of July party at their house without talking to her about it. Kind of like when she upgraded her engagement ring without talking to him about it first. So clearly, communication, not this couple's strong suit. In fact, Kim is so enraged by Pad planning this party without talking to her first. According to what Pad's friend Jamie told Fatal Vows, Kim attacked Pad with a wire coat hanger. Jamie declared that Pad, quote, "through good times and bad times, I think he loved her, and I think he hated her at the same time." Yeah, I would say so. In the aftermath of this attack, Kim begins yet another flirtation with a man who is not her husband. This time, it's the father of one of her son's classmates. He's divorced, which I guess is supposed to make things a little bit easier, but regardless, Pat discovers the messages that the two are sending to each other, and he says, "You know what? I'm done. I've had it. I am peacing out of this marriage," and he tells Kim he wants a divorce. Kim says, if he wants to divorce her, go right ahead. Bring it on. You see, New Mexico is a community property state, so Kim would have been entitled to half of everything. Not to mention she'd worked for the business, and remember, Pad is quite wealthy, so half of everything would be quite a lot. Losing half of everything to Kim would have been a blow to Pad's business, and he's not having it. Pad, and this is a level of petty that I could not come up with on even my best day, Pad ups the ante and gives several divorce attorneys in town hefty retainers, declaring that they were representing him in his divorce. And the reason why he does this is so that when Kim tries to get local representation, good luck, Chuck. It ain't going to happen. I can't represent you because I'm already representing your husband. This is some diabolical shiz, truly. Tensions between Pad and Kim are on 10. The frog is boiling in the pot and has no idea that the lid is about to blow clean off. May 31st, 2011. Pad's mom is visiting for the weekend, and Pad, instead of staying home and hanging out with his mom, he's golfing. Predictably, Kim is fuming about this. Later that same morning, a 911 call comes into local dispatch. It's Kim, and she tells the dispatcher that her husband has been hurt, that he tripped and fell on something and was bleeding from his chest. She's begging for them to send an ambulance fast. EMTs and sheriffs arrive at the house, and Pad tells them that he fell on a branch in his yard, basically impaling himself. The injury is bad. His heart has been punctured, and there is no coming back from this. He was declared dead shortly after arriving at the hospital. Podrick Pad Michael Guffey was 42 years old. Because Pad said that he had tripped and fell, the death was declared to be accidental. However, standard procedure dictates that there be further investigation into what happened. Kim tells investigators that she was asleep when Pad left that morning, that she dropped her son off at school, came home to work out, and that she and Pad had texted a bit throughout the morning. She insists she had no idea that her husband was even at home. She claims that she was in the kitchen making a smoothie when Pad burst into the kitchen through the back door with his chest bleeding. Kim says that she really didn't take him seriously at first because Pad had a penchant for overreacting. She said that she cleaned up a little bit because when her son came home from school, she didn't want him to see the blood in her kitchen. Is it just me, or does she seem to have an answer for pretty much everything? At any rate, Investigators take a look around and they can't find this mythical tree branch that Pat supposedly tripped on and impaled himself with. So they go back to Kim and say, "Is it possible that your husband was stabbed with something else?" Kim plays dumb, but Pat's mom, who remembers just happens to be visiting, she mentions that there was a letter opener on the kitchen counter a few nights before, but that it's not here now. Well, this gives investigators something to chew on, so they start to dig into Pat's last hours. So it turns out, I guess, before he was going to play golf, he went to work for a little bit that morning. So they interview Pat's employees, and one of them says that they saw Pat that morning around 10 talking on the phone, and he was extremely agitated. So, of course, investigators want to know, well, who was he talking to, and why was he so upset? Three guesses who he was talking to. Based on this information, investigators want to talk to Kim one more time, so she heads to the police station for a more extensive interview. Now, she had originally told investigators that she hadn't talked to Pat at all that morning, that they had only been texting. Well, now, knowing that Pat was having a heated phone call that morning, investigators say, "So were you only texting with Pat?" Now, Kim is no dummy because she has thought about this and she realizes that, oh, they can probably get the phone records. So she comes clean and she says, "Well, you know what? We might have talked on the phone that morning, about 20 minutes. My bad." She claims that he called her because he was paranoid that she wasn't at home alone, that she had another man at the house with her. And she says that Pat threatened to hurt himself if she was lying to him, which sounds convenient. Cops are like, this sounds all kinds of fakakta. So they take the step of interviewing the dispatcher about the 911 call. And the dispatcher says, "You know what? You should actually listen to the entire call." Well, that's interesting. Okay. So now we all know that 911 calls are recorded. But did you know that the recording starts while the phone is ringing? I didn't know that. Did you know that? So essentially, whatever you're saying before the call connects, it's being recorded. And you will not believe what Kim is saying when she thought no one is listening. For example, quote, "Please don't send me to the cops." Quote, "Say you fell, please. Please promise me. Will you promise me?" Quote, "Baby, I'm sorry." She instructs Pat to lay down and calm down and declares that, yes, she knows she's going to hell. She also says, "It's in the car. I would bet it's not a tree branch in the car." And then she actually says it. It's a slip, but she actually says, quote, "I stabbed my husband." Kim is full on panicking in that call, crying that Pat is bleeding, that she doesn't want him to die, begging him to say that it was an accident. Okay. So what did actually happen that morning? Well, Pat did call Kim that morning, we know that, and he is paranoid that she's there at home with somebody. I don't know where he might have gotten that idea. Maybe she told him that, I don't know. But she did say something on the phone that triggered Pat to jump in the car and race home from the office, all while they're still talking on the phone. He tells her she's not getting a dime from him, that she won't be able to find a lawyer to represent her, and they are just going at it. It's just one up, and things are heated, and just, it's bad. It's bad. The frog is about to come flying out of the pot. So Pat pulls up to the house, and he races inside. By now, Kim has got that letter opener that was on the kitchen counter in her hand, and she stabs her husband. Investigators believe the lack of any defensive wounds means Kim moved in fast and suddenly. Prosecutors likened it to an ambush. In a panic, Kim runs outside with the bloody letter opener, hides it in her car, then she calls 911. The evidence is overwhelming and indisputable. Kim is arrested and charged with involuntary manslaughter and tampering with evidence. During the sentencing hearing, Pad's mother, Aileen Guffey, stood up in court, I think this was probably a victim impact statement, and said, quote, "Kim had hated my son for a long time. Kim told him at one time she wished he was dead. All Pad was to her was a money basket for her needs." Kim, however, said in court, quote, "Pad's temper always started out where he would break something to scare me." Well, okay. Let's not forget the wire hanger episode. My opinion, for whatever it's worth, I think Kim probably gave as good as she got. I think she and Pad were probably both had tendencies, let's just say. And I'll just leave it at that. Kim took a plea deal and was sentenced to 2 years in prison and 1 year of probation. Thank you so much for joining me for another episode of The Dark Side of Love. I am your host, Bianca Sloan, and show your love for The Dark Side of Love by visiting thedarksideoflove.com for show notes and transcripts. While you're there, sign up for my newsletter to be notified about new episodes. You can also find a link to my Patreon page where you can access bonus material and other fun stuff. Learn more about my suspense novels about The Dark Side of Love by visiting biancasloan.com. Thanks for hanging out with me and join me next time for another tale of love gone wrong. I'll see you on the dark side.